Rebuilding Your Life, Moving from Disaster to Prosperity with Susan Chiraco, where we help you transform your life by changing what you're telling yourself. Whatever your circumstances, you can experience health, financial security, and a sense of well-being once again. And now, here's your host, Susan Chiraco.
On behalf of Rebuilding Your Life Radio and the Train Your Brain, Claim Your Power calls, welcome. Today I'm going to ask you a question. How many of you have taken part in mission trips to different parts of the world? Our guest today has been actively involved in such work for, I think, over 15 years. The work he does and the experiences he's had led him to write his book, God's Will in Cuba. So please wave your hands to welcome Daniel Fulton to share his journeys with us. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. How are you?
Oh, really good today.
Good. Glad to hear it. Daniel, I know I just mentioned that your book is about Christian ministries in which you were a participant, but how long have you been involved in this work?
Well, in the Cuba, Bibles for Cuba, I started in 2014, or my journey began in 2014. I went to Honduras in 2003 and 4 and I think 5. I've slept since then. But anyway, it started as just a tugging on my heart. You know how sometimes you just know that you should do something. I was one of these people that was the typical American consumer Christian. You know, I measured God's love by what God gave me. And he's given me very much in my life. He's given me plenty. But, again, I still wasn't happy. I think this was his way of letting me know that that's not how it is. In fact, I'm so sold on missions and short-term mission trips that they changed my life.
Well, what kind of work do you do when you go on these missions?
It varies. It depends on the mission. When I started down there, I've been a bricklayer, a masonry contractor all my life, 45 years and better. And the first mission that we were going to go on was building a chapel in Honduras. And I thought, wow, this is just down my alley. I'll just go to Honduras and we'll get that chapel built for God and, you know, things will be great. So we did. The poor guys that went with me, a lot of them were desk jockeys and retired, and I pretty much really, really almost killed them because I was used to the heavy labor all day long, and they weren't, but I was driven. I was going to get that done, and we did, but in the process of that, I found out something. God didn't need me down there to lay blocks. There are plenty of people in Honduras that are as good or better than I am at it. After all buildings down there are cement block buildings. They don't use wooden structures like we do here in the States in places, simply because the termites would eat them up. So down there, they use block. So that wasn't the reason I went down there. The reason I went down there was to change my attitude. And it did. I discovered that those people, especially the ones we hang out with when we're on mission trips, which are usually Christians or soon to be Christians, they have a joy. They have a contentment about them. They don't have much, but I so coveted that. You know what I mean?
The joy, yes.
The joy.
To see that. In spite of not having material possessions.
Exactly. And so that began my journey into missions, I found out
you came back. Yeah, you came back from Honduras. Did you go on another mission right away?
Pretty much one a year. Mm-hmm. And they were to Honduras to begin with. And I must tell you, when I came back from Honduras, I was an emotional wreck. The reason being, I enjoyed it so much that I thought, I've missed my calling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the calling, it was the fact of the giving.
Yes.
I went down there on my own dime. I spent better than a week down there. Worked hard. I mean, it's hot down there. And we worked hard pretty much all day long. But that was probably the most contented sore muscles that I ever had. You understand what I mean?
I do. There's an inner fulfillment and accomplishment there that not very many things give you in life. Yeah.
Yeah. But like I said, that's not why I was sent down there. Of course, I'm pretty stubborn. So it took a few trips for me to finally understand that, you know, I was being changed. We went
in
from
Honduras.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, oh much, much more contented, much more thankful for what I had, and not needing, you know, not being so needy. Can you imagine? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have children or not. I had four. Can you imagine? You know they're needy sometimes. Oh, okay.
Yes, they are.
Dad, can we have this? Can we have that? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that multiplied by billions and understand what God has to go through?
Yes. Turn it off. I don't want to hear it anymore.
Yeah, turn it off. I don't want to hear it anymore.
So you went there for like 3 years, but you don't go to Cuba right away. So
no, I actually, in the interim, we had Hurricane Katrina. We went to New Orleans.
Yes. Okay.
Cleaned up after that. We did that, I think, 2 or 3 years. You know, 2 or 3 years after a tornado like that or a mm-hmm. hurricane like that to clean it up and get people back mm-hmm. to where they were.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. I went to Cuba for the first time in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
It was a chance meeting. The fellow that used to go to our church that really organized the mission trips to Honduras, named Larry Johnson, he had retired and moved to Tennessee. He went to a church in Franklin Church, Franklin, Tennessee, Christian church. And he came home, and we were at dinner after church, and he mentioned that he was going to Cuba on missions. I said, oh, that sounds like fun. I said, I didn't even know you could go to Cuba. He said, oh, yeah. So this fellow's been going to Cuba for years and years. And I said, well, okay. And it turned out that there was an opening. I got things worked out, and I got to go to Cuba in 2014. And that's pretty much how the book and the ministry came about for me.
What did you find there? I mean, most of us have not had the opportunity to go to Cuba, and we have absolutely no idea. We know it's a communist or socialist government. We know
right.
it was under Castro's, you know, complete control or dictatorship, mm-hmm. I guess, for years. If we're old enough, we remember, you know, the battle, the war,
crisis.
The Cuban Missile Crisis, exactly.
Yes.
So, but we don't really know what it's like there. What is, you know, is this a time capsule? Is that what it feels like when you go there?
Exactly. The things that struck me first off, was the minute you get out of the airport, of course, it's a tropical country, so it just has smells and feels different than what I'm used to from the Midwest. And but you walk out of the airport, and there's these cars from the late 40s to the early to the late 50s. 1959 was the latest that anyone could get a car from America imported into Cuba, because Castro took over and nationalized everything, the resorts, the hotels, the restaurants, plantations, sugar plantations, anything that any outsider had was taken over by Castro. But you walk out the door and you see all these old cars, and I'm 70 years old. This is just nirvana to me. You know, I walk out and, wow, I'm walking back into my childhood here. I'm walking back into my teen year. There was 57 Chevys, you know. We even saw an Edsel there, and it was in really good shape. But most of them are indicative to the communist type government. Socialism, communism, dictatorship, whatever you want to call them, they're all bedfellows. You look at the cars from a distance, they look great, but you get close to them and it looks like maybe a 1940s battleship that's been painted and painted and painted with a brush, because that's exactly what's happened. They've kept these shells of the cars going all these years because they didn't have a choice. They didn't make cars in Cuba. They wouldn't import them from the United States. So the only other kind of cars you see are a few old Soviet Pradas. And now you see the Chinese cars, the newer Chinese cars. Mm. You also see a spattering of Japanese imports, that sort of thing. But it was just, you know, it was a feeling that I can't convey, because it was like walking into my childhood. But these things are the same as the communist government. They're false. The engines were different. The steering wheels were different. They'd been in the Cuban sun so long that all of the coating off of the metal on the steering wheels were gone, and some of them were replaced by just pieces of round metal welded together so they could turn the cars. It was that some of them didn't even have interiors. Exactly the way the communist governments work. I'll give you an example. Castro wanted everybody to know just how good Cuba was doing, so he has workmen build these houses in a row, and they were, you know, really nice, pristine, typical South American houses, and he had people move into them. This was in the sugar plantation areas of the country, basically the poorest part of Cuba. And he let everyone come in and take pictures. But he had guards. You didn't get past that row of houses, because behind that were the slums that everybody else has lived in for years, and they're still there.
Wow. So all for show.
It's all for show.
Wow. Do they have a lot of buses or means of transportation?
The transportation in Cuba, now, I'm not talking about charter buses. Since the government opened up the tourist trade, there are charter buses. You know, the people with the money that come from other countries. In fact, there's a lot of people from Canada that winter down there. But those buses run from the big cities to the big cities and to the places that the government wants you to see. As far as any kind of transportation for the normal working class person, you have your pesos, and if you have a voucher of some kind, and you put that in your hand and you go down to the local highway intersection and you wave that at whoever comes by, and if they have a seat available, they'll stop and they'll pick you up and take you where you're going, where you need to go. So if you have a job and you live in a different town, you're not going to make it to work on time hardly ever, because you're at the mercy of whoever comes by with an empty seat. Trucks that have cargo that go one way, they come back, they're full of people coming back the other way. That's the way it is.
That is just the way it is. Wow.
Yeah. Mm. And you get out away from Havana in the big cities, you'll see more horses and carriages than you will cars. And you'll see bicycles. And something that just scared me to death most of the time, I'm glad I wasn't driving, was the fact that these bicycles don't have lights. And these carriages, these horse-drawn carriages don't have lights. So if you're going anywhere after dark, you have to be very vigilant. In fact, that's one of the ministries that Russ Montgomery had. He had a roll of reflective tape with him, and he asked for permission. Every bicycle he ever saw, he would put a strip of that on the back of that bicycle so whoever was behind him could see him.
Wow.
That's just something he did.
What a simple thing to make a big difference in somebody's life. Wow.
That's what you'll find out when you go to mission trips. It's the simple thing.
Right. Well, what was your mission in Cuba? What was it you were actually doing there?
Well, we put water systems in. Cuba, like a lot of third world countries, don't have potable water everywhere, and especially in the outlying areas. So Russ came up with a system. It's got four filters on it and four gauges on it, and we hook it into the water system, and these filters filter out the bacteria and the bad things in the water, so whoever needs water can have it and not get sick from it. In fact, there was one of the first years that they went down there and did that, there were four churches in one area that had those, or no, excuse me, six churches that had those water systems. There was a hurricane that came through, and guess where the only place in that area you could get clean water was at the churches.
Oh, my goodness. Well, does that have an appeal to be able to provide water? Does it help the community in the bigger community than just the church?
Oh, yes. The church doesn't sell that water. The church gives it away. That's one of the stipulations of getting a water system, is you give that water away to anyone that wants it. And it is a tremendous, tremendous mission and way to witness to the people when they come to get water. In fact, this has been said more than once, a Cuban church that gets one of these water systems usually doubles in size within a year, or excuse me, within 2 years. So it's a very worthwhile and humanitarian effort. Even if it wasn't for the Christians are the ones that are doing it, it's a humanitarian effort for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to comprehend. Cuba's an island. It's completely surrounded by water. It's got mountains, so it has should have free-flowing water, you would think, from the higher regions down. How are they so – what do they not have that prevents them from having water?
It's pollution, just like everywhere else in the world. A lot of times it's animal byproducts. A lot of times it might be human byproducts or just waste from the foliage in the jungle. But when the water, and you're exactly right, they have water, but they don't have good, clean, potable water for that reason. I asked the same question when I was down there, and that's the answer I got. So it would be like you going down to a river or something and getting water. You're kind of playing Russian roulette there, aren't you? You don't know whether that water is going to make you sick or not. And that's pretty much the way the Cuban water system is. I was asking some questions about the system, and one of the Cubans said, yes, the water systems are in such terrible shape that not much more than 25% of the water that the municipal water system sends out gets to the people because of leaks, people stealing it, whatever. That's the system. That's the system.
This is amazing. I don't think anyone realizes that there is no infrastructure really in Cuba for these programs that we take so for granted, that, you know, we turn on a spigot and the water comes out and it's clean water.
Mm-hmm.
We have such vast salaries. I don't think we begin to comprehend how poor a nation, how poor the life is for the people who live in Cuba.
One example that I'll give you is this fellow. He looked ancient. He probably wasn't as old as I am, but, you know, being in the sun all the time can make you look a little older than you
mm-hmm.
are. He had on a Panama hat. He had reins around his. What I mean by reins are the controls for horses.
Mm-hmm.
Only this time it was mules. He had a one bottom plow and two mules pulling, and he was plowing a little plot of land that he had probably plowed all his life, and it was subsistence for him. He probably sold a little on the side, but it made sure that his family had whatever it was he grew to eat. And that's pretty much the way it is. You know, we had Victory Gardens during the war. They have gardens just to survive. You know, the Cuban people are very resilient. They thrive in spite of the government, not because of the government, regardless of what the government wants to tell you.
Now, we spoke before, and you told me a story about a box of Bibles that were given to one of the churches, and
right.
how significant that was.
Yes, these churches pretty much stand in line to get these water systems. We have to take them down there in our duffel bags when we go. We're actually smuggling them into the country because you can't buy anything in the United States and take it to Cuba. It's just not done. So anyway, we get down there and we put these water systems in, and we had a box of Bibles. Now, I was not privy to this information or anything beforehand. I stood there and I watched Russ Montgomery, who is the head, the one that started this ministry. I watched him give Bibles, this case of Bibles, to the pastor, who was already overwhelmed because of the water system and what that was going to mean to his community. And he cried.
Are they that are they that hard to come by, or that expensive that people can't get a Bible?
You know, I don't know what the local stores. Let's just use $10 for an example. $10 mm-hmm. is a month's salary down there for most people.
Mm.
Of course, it's a different currency, and it sounds like more when you get it, but that's basically what it is. And the Bibles that we get, and we get them wholesale. I think they're coming from Korea right now, but we import those from a different country like Korea or whoever's got them the cheapest, and then we don't have to worry about tariffs and things from the United States. So
mm-hmm.
that's how they get them down there. We don't take them down. They're already shipped in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that just made such an impression on me. So I decided mm-hmm. that's what I was going to do. I was going to try to get as many Bibles into Cuba as I possibly could.
And how do you do that?
Well, there's different ways. Of course, Russ has his website that you can give money directly to Living in Faith Ministries. You can specify that. He has many ministries in the different countries. He's an eye doctor, and he does eye surgery in Haiti and Dominican Republic. So, you know, he's a busy man. But if you stipulate on their Bibles for Cuba, you can be part of the solution just by that simple act. Or you can pray about it, you know.
And that Bibles also not, helps. Yep.
Yeah, Bibles are not illegal in Cuba. They're just not available. And they're just, if they were available, the people couldn't afford the money that it takes to buy one. I have another little story about that. There was a fellow that Russ knew. He and his wife were new converts, and they wanted a Bible so bad so they could read the Word. Of course, there were none available, and they were just a typical Cuban couple. They had one daughter. They found a Bible, a used Bible, that someone was willing to part with, and it was around $10, and that's all the money they had until the next stipend came in from the government. They spent that $10 on a Bible. They had one egg left. They fixed it for their daughter, and they went without food for days to get that Bible.
That's powerful. That's very powerful that they would do that. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So are you still going on these missions?
I have not been able to in the last few years. In 2017, I had a medical problem, couldn't go. And from then on, I've been taking care of my father every other month. And so I just haven't had the free time and been available when the trip's been available. So, no, I haven't. I would really, really like to go back. That was some of the most fulfilling things, and I didn't do a whole lot. I like to say the Juan Carlos, our plumber, that put in those systems, he could go in, look at, see what size pipe it was and everything it set up. And if the gringos weren't there helping him, he'd probably be done in 20 minutes. With gringos' help, it was 45.
Do you think things have changed since you were there?
Maybe a little, but still, there's been no earth-moving type change. Castro died. His brother took over. He's getting feeble, and another fellow took over whom I cannot even remember his name. But everything is status quo.
So tell us, you've written a book. It's called God's Will in Cuba. Why did you call it that? And what do you think, what is your purpose in writing it?
Well, for the first question, Russ Montgomery was in Cuba. He was in Havana the first time he got permission to go. Didn't really know what he was going to do for the country yet. And incidentally, this is their 25th anniversary. So this was 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He faced Havana, and he prayed. He said, God, what can I do for this country? And that's how the water systems came about. That was one of the needs that was kind of under the radar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy bottled water if you have the money. They have the same system as we do, that bottles potable water and then sells it. But most people can't afford to do that. And it's really sometimes hard for them even to be able to get the fuel to boil water. And that's what they have to do in the case they can't buy it, is boil it if they don't want to get sick.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it came about. Of course, I came in many, many years later, and the Bibles came about from that. But his story there, his prayer, God, tell me what I need to do, is why I called it God's Will in Cuba.
Okay. So this is part of your active mission now, to get your awareness of your book and awareness of Living in Faith Ministries, which is
right.
Russ Thompson's program. Okay.
Yeah, Russ Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Russ
and,
Montgomery. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The I don't know. I suppose that I was being nudged to write it. It's just a travelogue. It's not a very big book. It's a good simple read for a 2-hour airplane ride, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to convey in there what life is like outside of the Cuba that the Castros and the Communist Party would like everybody to think. There's places where the Russians built their typical big square box apartment buildings for the masses. They're depressing just to look at, but there's a lot of them there that are unfinished. When the Russians pulled out, the Cubans could not continue the work. They didn't have the money. Also, there are trellises to nowhere, I guess you would call them. They're road construction. They brought the overpass up to the road and stopped. So the reason is the Soviets pulled out. They were out of money.
Oh, my goodness. What a strange turn of events to have to be just in midstream, you know, midair of construction.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Stop like that.
Yeah, they just stopped. They just they couldn't afford to keep Cuba as an ally anymore. They were too expensive.
Wow. Well, this is certainly an interesting insight into Cuba and also into mission service as it can be provided. I see a lot of different people advertising missions in Africa and did not realize until your book that there is a need for missions of the same type to get water, to get medical assistance, to get to get something as simple as a Bible into the hands of people in Cuba. That's fascinating. So thank you very much for being with us, Daniel. I'd like to remind our listeners that we've been talking about your book, God's Will in Cuba. And where can they go to find your books?
They can go on Amazon. Just type in God's Will in Cuba, and it will come up. It's by Westbow Press, so they'll know they got the right one. And it's got a picture of one of the churches in Cuba that was typical. This church is at one time has been a very, very elaborate church, but time and neglect has pretty much done the same thing to it as what the Communist Party did to Cuba.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you also to our listeners for joining us today. Remember, nothing supports the work of authors better than picking up a copy of their books. You can also support the work of this program by going to the Anchor FM podcast, Train Your Brain, Claim Your Power, to like us or follow us, sponsor or subscribe to the podcast. We thank you for letting us give authors a voice. So thanks again for being with us, Daniel.
I surely appreciate it, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
I'm so glad. So once again, it's time to go, everybody. Bye for now, and have a great day.
Thank you very much for tuning in today. If you've been inspired by this show, leave a rating or review on iTunes and visit www.rainbowsoverruins.com to receive a free chapter from Susan's book. On behalf of Susan Shirako, this has been Rebuilding Your Life, Moving from Disaster to Prosperity, sharing the journeys of those affected by sudden and great loss and what they did to heal, rebuild, and where they are now.